This is the story of Esmeralda.
It was the one thing that bound us together, the one thing we had in common.
The pine tree covered him in sticky, sticky sap from head to toe.
We love stories!
It's time for the Apple Seed, filled with stories for you and your family, all kinds of tales from all kinds of tellers. I'm Sam Payne, your host. Such a pleasure to have you with us today. Every time you tune in to bring these stories into your home and into your heart, we just love it. And today's going to be a great hour. We're going to bring you stories from Finn Billy, from Fran Yardley, from the Story Crafters, and more. You're going to hear a story called When I Was 10, about the complications of family relationships and how perspective can help us realize that things are often better than they seem. You're going to hear a story from Fran Yardley called May I Have This Dance, about learning to love the things about yourself that make you different. You're even going to hear a rap from the Story Crafters on the story The Tortoise and the Hare. And it's all coming up. We're going to start with a story from Finn Billy. This is called When I Was 10. In his true story, Billy talks about how when he was younger, he felt that his older brother was his mother's favorite. Have you ever felt that way? This feeling that his mother cares more for his brother than for him causes him to act out in some rather foolish ways. But as Finn gets older, he comes to realize that his mother loves him just as much as his brother and appreciates both of her children, each of her children as unique individuals. Here's When I Was 10. Happy to bring it to you on the Appleseed.
When I was 10 years old, my 12-year-old brother, Pia, gave my mother his painting of our street on the outskirts of Copenhagen. He had captured the scene exactly right, that gray cobblestone road that wound down the hill under the viaduct, the red train that crossed the viaduct, the yellow house on the left in which we lived, and the mound in the foreground of the picture, with a stovepipe sticking out of it and smoke swirling out of it. That mound covered the dugout that my brother and I had built together. It was the one thing that bound us together, the one thing we had in common, and now it was in his picture. I was there in the room when he gave my mother that painting. It was his first oil painting. He handled it by the stretch frame in the back, so that he wouldn't get the paint smudged, because the paint was still wet. He held it out to her as though he was giving an offering to a goddess, and of course he was. She reached around with her right hand to hold the stretch frame in the back, because she realized that the paint was still wet. She looked at that painting, she looked at my brother and smiled. Then she held the painting out and hugged my brother. And from across the room, his blonde hair looked just like a halo on her dark gray sweater. Oh, it was a beautiful moment. And I was happy for them and for all of us. For a moment. And then I felt excluded. I felt like she was giving all her love to my brother and none to me. Like I wasn't even there, that I was not in the picture. So I left and walked down the stairs and out to the front yard and stood there next to the dugout. I looked up at the windows in our house where our apartment was, and I waved my arms like a maroon sailor waving at a distant ship. Can you see me now? Am I in the picture now? But of course I knew that they couldn't then. I wasn't. So I sat down on the brink of our dugout and I slid down onto the burlap floor, and I looked around. I saw shovel marks in the walls of the dugout, and I remembered how we had dug that hole out together. And then we had put branches and boards across that hole, covered it with an old tent, and piled dirt on top of it until it sagged. When we realized it sagged too much, my brother and I got down under there with a board, and we struggled and sweated together until we were able to push that roof up underneath. And now I felt of it, and it felt firm, strong. I smelled the half-burnt leaves and paper in the stove that we'd installed together, the acrid stench of half-burned branches and leaves stung my nose. But then I felt a tightening of my chest. I could hardly breathe. I was about to cry because I realized that I'd lost something with my brother. I jumped out of there and stood on the brink of the dugout and took a deep breath. I realized that I had chores to do because, you see, my brother and I shared the task of carrying fuel from the basement up to the stoves in our apartment. Those stoves burned coke, a degasified coal that came in jagged, dark gray, but lightweight chunks. So I was carrying a bucket of coke when I saw my brother out in the front yard. I picked up a chunk of coke and looked at it in the dark gray, jagged mass, and I looked out at his blonde hair, and I remembered how that blonde hair had formed a halo on my mother's dark gray sweater. I looked back and forth at the coke, his blonde head, back to the coke, then to his blonde head again. And then I threw that chunk of coke as hard as I could, aiming to hit over his head, to miss him so that I wouldn't hurt him. But immediately he bent over with a howl, and when he came back up, red blood was running through his blonde hair into his blue eye. And he came running past me up the stairs, and I was right behind him. "Sorry, sorry, I didn't mean to hit you." He went straight to my mother, and once again she gave all her attention to him. And there she was, washing the blood off his face and looking at me with accusing glances. But I said, "Mom, Mom, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hit him." But she knew, and I knew, that I was not sorry enough. Right above them on the wall in Pierce painting, the red paint looked just like the shiny red blood in Pierce blonde hair. I felt sad. Something had broken between my brother and me. But another feeling came to me, one of a kind of triumph of having asserted myself, maybe having gotten into the picture after all. But really, sadness prevailed. 40 years later, I came to visit my mother from the United States, where I had immigrated. I'd been back several times, but this time I came back to give her a copy of my book of poems, Rights of the Earth. I gave it to her at her country house when my brother was right there in the room. I handed it to her with my left hand, and she reached around with her right hand, looked at it, looked at me with a puzzled look. Rights of the Earth? What did that mean? I opened it up and showed her that there are many poems inside, and she smiled and nodded. From across the room, my brother smiled and nodded as well. I opened a book and read this poem aloud to them. When I was 10, I disappeared in the flower bed under the beech next to the locust. We sat hunkered under clods hung and falling from branches and boards. We had dug to our own depth and built a fire in our own earth stove. I would snake through the hatch, the heel of my hand slipping on the clay brink, and slide to the burlap floor. Here, the funky earth smell and the acrid smoke of papers and damp twigs afire became our sacrament. We would sit hidden, quiet, warm, the only sign to the adult world, the swirling smoke mingling above with winter fog. When I'd finished, we were all quiet for quite a while. My brother nodded and smiled again from across the room. And then I hugged my mother. And I know that from where Pierre was standing, it looked like her gray hair formed a halo on my dark blue shirt. Behind us, in the painting. The train was still crossing the viaduct. The smoke was still swirling out of that stovepipe. And the paint was dry.
When I Was 10, a story told for you by Finn Billy. Happy to bring it to you here on the Appleseed. And there's a lot more coming up. You're going to hear from Fran Yardley and Laura Deal. Something from the Story Crafters, too. You won't want to miss a word. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to the Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed. Coming up, you're going to hear stories from the Story Crafters and Laura Deal and Fran Yardley. But first, how about an entry into Radio Family Journal?
The Radio Family Journal with Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it. On The Appleseed.
For a kid interested in singing at American Fork Junior High School, it was the absolute pinnacle gig you could get. A spot in the Junior Patriots, the show choir led by Mr. Mortensen. Singing with the JPs had turned my head from being first chair clarinetist in the 8th grade B class of the junior high school band, which was tough to do because, I mean, first chair, right? But when auditions came up, I rolled the dice, and I made the cut. Soon, I was wearing the Junior Patriots uniform, a dark blue suit made of polyester, tough enough that you couldn't cut it with a bandsaw, and a white dress shirt and a red and white striped necktie. The girls wore blue plaid skirts and bright red sweater vests over white dress blouses, and thus attired, we were the unmistakable fighting force of junior high school choral excellence. We had a theme song, even, with choreography. The song went, "Every guy, every girl, every guy and girl is needed to make a new tomorrow." There was more, but you get it, right? We did gigs outside of school hours. We'd play old folks' homes and elementary school assemblies, singing "Let There Be Peace on Earth" and "Let It Begin with Me" in choral arrangements of Beatles songs. And in the spring, we went on a trip. A trip, a performance tour. A bunch of ninth graders and a couple of chaperones and all our uniforms safely stowed in the bays beneath the school bus. We were going to be on a tour performing in the gymnasiums of regional middle schools for exactly 2 days and one night. And when seatmates were chosen for the tour, I had the impossible good fortune of being assigned to sit next to Aaron Brown, the Junior Patriots accompanist. I had a crush on Aaron that wouldn't go away, at least it hadn't all during ninth grade, and, well, this trip was going to be even better than any of us had ever imagined. It was an amazing 2 days. We performed at rural junior high schools all over the state, and once for an actual high school, kids older than we were. We ate continental breakfasts, which sounded super fancy, but were really just Egg McMuffins and juice. We stayed in a hotel far from home and went swimming in the hotel pool. And Aaron Brown absolutely, steadfastly, wholeheartedly did not fall in love with me. I made room in my backpack for my Walkman and a cassette copy of Speak and Spell, the 1981 Depeche Mode album, and an adapter so you could listen to the Walkman with two pairs of headphones. And I brought an extra pair for Erin, and she listened with me to New Life and Just Can't Get Enough, and we sang the choruses and the harmonies from the album, and Erin didn't fall in love with me. In the hotel, Aaron and her roommates sent someone to run interference with the chaperones so she and Brenda Birch and Melissa Sheets could visit me and my roommates in our room and present us with candy bars they'd sneaked out to buy at the corner gas station. And each candy bar was chosen specially for the guy for whom it had been chosen for reasons, like mine was a Clark bar because they said I looked like Clark Kent. This was a long time ago. Remember, it was mostly my glasses, I think. And Aaron didn't fall in love with me. Finally, on the way home from the trip, about an hour away from the junior high school parking lot where our parents would pick us up, chugging up the freeway across the Utah desert, just as we passed a place where a hill had been cut away to make room for the road to come through, Aaron Brown, exhausted from 2 days of buying candy bars and listening to Depeche Mode and swimming in the hotel pool and singing for rural junior high school kids and accompanying the junior patriots on the piano, Aaron Brown fell asleep on my shoulder. Nothing more ever happened than that, and the truth is, during that trip, Aaron Brown moved on, developed a crush on Brett Bunker. I should have seen it coming, but you know what? I can still point out the spot on the freeway where it happened. Junior high school crushes are dumb like that. A couple of months after school ended and Aaron Brown moved away. But I gotta say, 2 days full of Depeche Mode and subterfuge and candy bars and swimming in the hotel pool and Aaron Brown falling asleep on my shoulder as a member of the Junior Patriots, well, it beat the heck out of anything that ever happened to me as first chair clarinetist in the 8th grade B class of the junior high band. That's for dang sure.
The Radio Family Journal with Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it, on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining me for that entry in the Radio Family Journal. We always hope that the stories that we bring you here on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people that you love as stories. Share them with us, too. You can reach out to us at theappleseed@byu.edu. Some of our favorite stories come from folks like you who listen to the show. And we're going to get to a wrap on Tortoise and the Hare by the Story Crafters in a bit here. A story called May I Have This Dance, too, by Fran Yardley. And first, though, how about a conversation with a friend? Great stories come into our lives in so many ways, from tales handed down, telling to telling around the campfire or the living room or the kitchen table, to the stuff we see on screen, to the things that we experience in great books or great music, and of course, through the wonderful interactions that we have with terrific food. And of course, the ways that great stories get down into our hearts and minds is something that we love to talk about here on the Appleseed. And we love to talk about it with friends. I got a friend in the studio today. We're talking about Jenna Parker. Jenna Parker, it's a pleasure to have you with us on the Appleseed.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And I got to tell you, one of my very favorite phrases in any language is the phrase, a la mode.
It's a good one, for sure.
And you have maybe a little more experience with that phrase than some people do. You are, of course, the proprietor of Max a la Mode. Tell us a little bit about Max a la Mode.
So Max a la Mode is my business. We make macaroon ice cream sandwiches, French macaron ice cream sandwiches, depending on how you want to say it. So they are just giant macaroons, French macaroons, and instead of the frosting that you would have in the middle or a ganache filling, it's ice cream.
It's ice cream.
It's delicious ice cream.
And it's kind of custom ice cream, too. I mean, this is not like...
Yep. There's some really good flavors that people might not have a lot.
How did this come about? How did you have this idea?
So it actually happened. My son was a year old, and I wanted a hobby, something to do. I started making French macaroons. I wanted to cater, do weddings and things like that. And I just was trying to pinpoint the best recipe. At the same time, my sister went on a cruise and she came back and said, I had this giant macaron filled with gelato. It was the best thing I've ever eaten. You have to make these.
Ding! Off went the light bulb.
Yes, yes. About a month later, Max a la Mode was born.
Oh, golly. Okay. Well, I'm trying to imagine what, like, my favorite flavor of ice cream, macaron ice cream sandwich might be.
Right. And any flavor of ice cream that you can dream, we can do. The most popular flavor we have right now is actually, and from the beginning, has been Fruity Pebbles, believe
fruity
it or not.
Fruity Pebbles?
Yep. So we take Fruity Pebbles cereal and we mix it into vanilla ice cream, and it is so good. It has never left our menu since we opened. So.
Fruity Pebbles were, when I was a kid, mm-hmm. were like
That was like the dream cereal
right.
that you only saw on TV.
Right.
And every once in a while, you might Fruity Pebbles might come through the door of your house, and you kind of went, woohoo!
Yes. So. My husband says that taking a bite of that Fruity Pebbles ice cream just transports him back to being a kid watching those Saturday morning cartoons with a big bowl of Fruity Pebbles.
That's where Fruity Pebbles takes me.
Yes.
Exactly. That same place. But we should compare favorite Saturday morning cartoons, though. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Does your husband talk about his favorites?
You know, it's,
let's leave him out of it.
Right.
What were your favorite Saturday morning cartoons?
Oh, my favorites. I don't even. It's been so long. What were some of yours?
My favorite Saturday. Well, listen, we watched Bugs Bunny till we couldn't stand up.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. Looney Tunes was always a big one in our house.
Yeah, but I come from the era of, listen, I don't even know if a lot of people have heard of these cartoons, but I come from the era of like Thundar the Barbarian cartoons. You're not even with me, are you? You're like, I'm going home to look that up.
Might have been a little before my time.
Yeah. Thundar the Barbarian and, of course, oh gosh, there was The Amazing Spider-Man. We listened to we watched Spider-Man cartoons.
Yep.
And it was always introduced by Stan Lee and signed off at the end with Stan Lee's Excelsior, you know. Boy, yeah, Saturday morning cartoons. And all you have to do is mention Fruity Pebbles and I'm back there.
Absolutely.
But what other flavors of macaron ice cream sandwich can we find walking through the doors of Mac's a la mode?
So another classic we do that's pretty universally liked is the cookies and cream. I don't think there's very many people who can turn down a classic cookies and cream. Recently, we did pistachio. That one was a big hit, too. It's a really classic regular macaron flavor as well across France and everywhere else where you can get macaroons. Pistachio is a pretty common flavor, so it was fun to bring that one in ice cream as well.
So I got to know if you – did you do some travel to –
You know what? I have
as research.
I wish I could say maybe in the future I have a business expensible trip to France to get some more research for Max a la mode. But so far I haven't.
So you talked about your husband's favorite, the Fruity Pebbles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but what's your favorite? I mean, I know there's sometimes a difference between what most people order, right?
Yes, there's always a difference. My favorite is the strawberry, actually. That was one of our original four flavors we did at our grand opening. We bring it back pretty regularly. We'll actually have it pretty soon here again because I can't get enough of that one.
I come from such an ice cream loving family. Mm-hmm. And maybe I don't even need to say that. Maybe that's every family.
Pretty
in America,
universal,
right? But we go to the store and we just stock up. It's like everybody in the family picks their favorite box of ice cream.
Right.
And they're all, the more chocolate, the better for most people.
Right.
And I'm kind of I got to have a carton of strawberry ice cream.
Right.
I'm that guy.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. My husband and I would go to Cold Stone or other ice cream places. He would get one that was very chocolate heavy, and I'm over here with the strawberry and the fruity flavors for sure.
Oh man! Well, like I say, you have not dissuaded me from a la mode being one of my favorite phrases in every language. In fact, I'm suddenly like more jazzed than ever to try a little Max a la mode. It's been such a pleasure to sit in the studio for just a minute and reminisce a little bit even about Saturday morning cartoons with Jenna Parker, again, the proprietor of Max a la mode. Can we find you online?
Yes, absolutely. We're on Instagram and Facebook, just at Max a la mode. And we just opened our storefront in Orem in October.
Fantastic. Jenna, thanks for joining us on the Appleseed.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Great stories come into our lives in so many ways. Such a pleasure to chat with Jenna Parker. Going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with a story called May I Have This Dance? A story told for you by Fran Yardley on the Appleseed.
You're listening to the Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed. And coming up, we've got a story from, the story crafters are going to wrap for us the story of the tortoise and the hare. But first, a story called May I Have This Dance. This is Fran Yardley. And in this story, Esmeralda loves to dance, but as she gets older, she begins to become self-conscious about her social skills and her appearance. She stops dancing and begins wishing that she were someone else. Perhaps you can understand what it feels like to be self-conscious about your appearance, maybe after a bad haircut, or if you were considered too tall or too short. Well, Esmeralda enrolls in a social dance class and learns to love the things about her that make her different.
And maybe you can too. Friend Yardley with May I Have This Dance on the Appleseed.
This is the story of Esmeralda. Esmeralda lived with her mother and her father and her two sisters. And when she was little, the thing she liked to do more than anything else in the whole world was to dance. She would dance to music on the radio. She danced when her sisters practiced the piano. She even danced to music inside her own head. But time went on, and Esmeralda began to grow. She grew, and she grew, and she grew. Until when she was 13 years old, she was 6 feet, 3 inches tall. And by this time, she no longer felt like dancing. But what was she to do? Life went on, and so did she. Every day she would get up and get ready for school. She would get dressed and get her books together, have breakfast, and then bend over to kiss her parents goodbye and go out to wait for the school bus. She hated the school bus. Whenever she was on it, she always had to sit all by herself because her legs were so long she couldn't put them in front of her. There was no room, so they had to go out to the side, and there was no room for anyone else to sit with her. And then when she was in school, she would try to tuck her legs under those little wooden desks so they didn't stick out in the aisle and trip anyone. Except sometimes, when Cricket Hammond came along. He was a boy in her class. She didn't mind tripping him, because he was always sneaking up behind her and saying things like, "Hey, Stretch, how's the weather up there?" She felt very lonely, but she didn't talk to anybody about how she felt because she was sure they wouldn't understand. Well, one day, her mother picked her up from school. And in the car on the way home, she said, "Ez, I have the most terrific news for you. You'll never guess who I saw today. Mrs. Driscoll. She said, you could go to her dancing school this year. Isn't that wonderful? You start next month." Esmeralda thought she would die. "Mom, please don't make me go to dancing school. I'm too young. I'll trip, I'll fall. I don't have anything to wear. Mom, please don't make me go. I'll do the dishes for a whole week, I promise." She pleaded and she bribed and she cried, but nothing worked. Her mother said, "You're right, you don't have anything to wear. Sounds to me like a trip to the department store is in order, young lady." And so she was marched down to the department store and made to try on about 15 crinkly, shiny, noisy dresses, which all poofed up and made her feel like her underwear showed. Every one of them was too short, and some of them were too tight, and none of them fit in all the right places. But finally, they picked out a lime green dress and a pair of flat shoes to go with it. And then on the day that she'd been dreading for weeks, the day of the beginning of dancing school, her mother marched her down to Vinnie to get her hair cut. Vinnie took one look at Esmeralda and said, "Esmeralda, it's wonderful to see you. My, how we've grown. Well, sit right down here, dear. Let's just see what magic we can perform." And then he proceeded to cut her hair so short that her bangs stuck out straight from her freckly face. In the car on the way home, she was thoroughly miserable. She pulled down the visor and peered into it and tugged on her bangs to make them longer. And then she closed her eyes and she made a wish. She said, I wish that I'm 5 feet 5 inches tall. And that I'm beautiful. And that I've got long, blonde, shining hair like Georgina Duquette. And I wish that all the boys like me. She opened her eyes and peered into the mirror. But nothing had changed. When they got home, it was already late afternoon, and her mother said, "All right, young lady, upstairs with you to have a bath. Mr. Victor's driving carpool tonight. He'll be here at 6:30, so you'll be at dancing school by 7 o'clock sharp. You know the Driscolls don't want you to be late." Esmeralda had never met Mr. and Mrs. Driscoll. They were the ones who ran the dancing school. But she had heard plenty of rumors from the older kids about Dracula Driscoll and plastic face Jane. So she dragged her gangly legs up the stairs and took her bath, and the hour went by, and before she knew it, there she was, down at the dining room table. She was dressed, ready to go. She'd had her dinner, waiting for Mr. Victor to pick her up. Her legs felt scratchy from the petticoat under her dress. She had huge butterflies in the pit of her stomach. She closed her eyes and she said, I wish that I'm 5 feet 5 inches tall, and that I'm beautiful, and that I have long, blonde, shining hair like Georgina Duquette. And I wish that I live on an isolated island in Canada with my faithful dog, and the only thing I have to wear are blue jeans and flannel shirts, and I can go barefoot all the time, and nobody cares a hoot about how tall I am. She was deep in the middle of this reverie when she was awakened from it by the tooting of a car horn. It was Mr. Victor come to pick her up. Her father stood up and he said, "Well, this is it. My little girl, off to go dancing. Go get 'em, Slicker." Her mother followed her out into the hallway and handed her her white gloves. "Oh, you look so beautiful," she said. "The boys are gonna love you. You're going to have the best time. Don't forget to say hello to Mr. and Mrs. Driscoll for me." And then she escorted her out the door. Esmeralda went down to the curb. There was Mr. Victor waiting. Now, Wendy and Roger and Bobby were already in the back seat, so she climbed in the front and said hi to everybody, and off they went. It wasn't until they got onto Main Street that the pit in her stomach grew even bigger butterflies, because she knew that they weren't far from the hotel where dancing school was held. She automatically pushed down on her dress to make it not so poofy, and she tugged on her bangs to make them longer, and then they were there. Getting out of the car, saying, "Goodbye, Mr. Victor, thanks. Bye, kids, see you in an hour." 1 hour, Esmeralda thought. It might as well be a year. She saw other kids also coming out of other cars, and oh, there she saw Sandy Stewart. She was getting out of her mother's Volkswagen. Sandy had on a bright orange dress, which was in direct competition with her red hair. But that's the way Sandy was, forward and loud and cheerful, always ready with a laugh, always with a group of friends around her. Esmeralda wondered how she did it. A good start was the fact that she was only 5 feet 3 inches tall. Esmeralda looked around and she realized that she really was the tallest one there. And then she saw another car pull up, and out of it stepped David Laufer. Esmeralda turned away. She'd had a crush on David Laufer ever since the third grade. And, well, she just didn't want to have him see her looking like a lime green lollipop. But she peeked back over her shoulder, and out of the car stepped a girl. Oh, it was Georgina Duquette. She had on a simple dress and a little hat perched on her long, blonde, shining hair. And the worst thing of all was, as she stood next to David Laufer, she only came up to his shoulder. Esmeralda closed her eyes and she said, I wish that I'm 5 feet 5 inches tall right now, and that I'm beautiful, and that I have long, blonde, shining hair like you know who. And I wish that I feel comfortable talking to anybody, especially David Laufer. She felt herself moving, and when she opened her eyes, she was in the middle of this whole crowd of kids heading towards the doors of the hotel. They all surged in and deposited their hats and coats, and then they started up this wide staircase. Esmeralda could hear music coming from the top of the staircase, dancing music. Her heart was pounding. As she got close to the top, she could see why it was that the line was going slowly, because at the top, as each boy and girl entered the room up there, they had to bow or curtsy in front of this couple. That had to be Dracula Driscoll and Plastic Face Jane. Esmeralda panicked. She'd never curtsied before in her life, except once in kindergarten when she'd been in a play, but that was a long time ago. She didn't remember how. So she watched Sandy Stewart, who was right ahead of her. Sandy strode into the room, grabbed Mr. Driscoll by the hand, and pumped it up and down and said, "Hello, Mr. Driscoll, boy, this is really fun." And then she dropped a neat curtsy in front of Mrs. Driscoll. It was Esmeralda's turn next. She was trembling. She did not want to go into that room and see the look of amazement on their faces when they realized how tall she was. So she kept her eyes down to the very last minute. But as her eyes located the shiny shoes of Mr. Driscoll, they involuntarily rose past his creased pants leg, past his cummerbund, past his bow tie, and to his face, where she looked into the kindest eyes she'd ever seen. She was so transfixed by them that for a minute, she did not even realize that she was actually looking up. Mr. Driscoll was taller than she was by a good 3 inches. He was saying, "Good evening, my dear. It's a pleasure to meet you. Tell me, what is your name?"
Esmeralda, sir.
"Well, Esmeralda, I'm delighted to meet you. Perhaps later you would give me the pleasure of a dance with you. And now let me introduce my wife. Mrs. Driscoll, this is Esmeralda." Esmeralda felt herself moving down the line, and Mrs. Driscoll said, "Oh, hello, my dear. I'm so pleased to meet you. Tell me, how are your dear parents?" "Oh, they're fine. My mom says to say hello." "Hi." And then she remembered a curtsy. "Well, please do give her my very best. And now do join the others. We'll begin dancing soon." Esmeralda was in a state of shock. She'd never met 2 nicer, more friendly people in her whole life. Mr. Driscoll had actually made her feel short. She was hoping she'd be able to dance with him. But now she faced this huge expanse of hardwood floor. Along one wall were all the boys, leaning against the wall with their hands in their pockets, trying to look cool and bored. And along the other wall were all the girls in little groups, whispering together and peeking over their shoulders at the boys. Esmeralda headed for the girls. It was her plan to find a chair so she could sit down and blend in better. But by the time she got there, all the chairs were taken. So she stood awkwardly next to Karen and Ginger. "Hi, Ginger. Whew, boy, it's hot in here, isn't it?" "Oh, hey, Es, how's it going?" Great. She began to think about looking around for the girls' room when Mr. and Mrs. Driscoll came gliding out onto the dance floor. Mrs. Driscoll whirled around a few times and she said, "Well, welcome, everyone. We're so glad you're here. Now, Mr. Driscoll and I are going to show you a very simple step, the waltz step. And then we want you all to come out here and try it." And with that, she gestured to a woman in the corner who began playing the piano. Mr. Driscoll bowed and said, "May I have this dance?" Mrs. Driscoll curtsied. She put her left hand on his shoulder and her right hand in his left, and they began to whirl around the room. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And then they slowed way down to show exactly how the step was done. One, two, three. One, two, three. And then they picked it up again. One, two, three, one, two, three. And they kept it up until the music stopped. And then Mrs. Driscoll said, "All right, everyone, now it's your turn. Choose your partners." "Oh, God," thought Esmeralda. All the girls looked as if they were glued to the wall. After quite a bit of urging from Mr. Driscoll, the boys began running and skidding across the hardwood floor and bowing to various girls. Esmeralda's face felt beet red. Her hands felt huge. She didn't know where to put them. She closed her eyes and she said, I wished that I am 5 feet, 5 inches tall. She opened one eye and she saw David Laufer bowing to Georgina Duquette. "Ooh, and that I'm beautiful." She opened both eyes and she saw that she was the only girl besides one other who was still standing against the wall, and that I have long, blonde, shining hair like, "May I have this dance?" Esmeralda opened her eyes wide. She looked up. Mr. Driscoll was standing in front of her. Somehow, she remembered to curtsy, and then she followed him out onto the dance floor, frantically trying to remember all the things that she'd just been taught. And the next few minutes went more smoothly than she would have ever thought possible. She simply glided around the room, feeling light and graceful and beautiful. She began to focus on what Mr. Driscoll was saying. He said, "It's a pleasure to dance with someone as tall as you are, my dear. You're doing so well. Oh, here, this foot goes here for this part. Yes, very good, my dear. So isn't it wonderful to be tall?" "Well, two, three, one, two, three," said Esmeralda, who was trying to count, think, listen to Mr. Driscoll, and dance all at the same time. Mr. Driscoll was listing some of the advantages of being tall. "For instance," he said, "whenever we're in a crowd, we never have to worry about where we stand." When Esmeralda had a chance to think about it, she realized he was right. Whenever she went to her sister's soccer games, she didn't care where she stood. She could see anyway. Mr. Driscoll was saying, "I've always thought that it's good to see things from different directions. And we are so lucky that we can see things from up high. Oh, that was a lovely twirl, my dear. Well done. Never forget, Esmeralda, to reach as high as you can." And with that, the music stopped. Mr. Driscoll said, "Thank you so much. That was a pleasure." "Oh, thanks, Mr. Driscoll. That was fun." She began thinking about looking around for the girls' room again when she heard a voice behind her. "Can I have this dance?" She turned around, and there was David Laufer bowing in front of her. "Well, sure, David, I mean, I'm supposed to curtsy, aren't I?" She giggled, and he laughed, and they began to dance. As they were dancing, he said, I couldn't help but see you dancing with Mr. Driscoll, and I was just wondering if, oh, I just stepped on your toe, didn't I?" "Oh, that's okay, David, I've got 9 other ones." "Well, I was just wondering if maybe you could help me with this dance thing a little bit." Esmeralda helped David Laufer, the one she'd had a crush on ever since the 3rd grade, the one who'd come with you-know-who with the blonde hair. "Well, sure, David. I mean, I don't know much more than you do, but we can give it a try." Well, during that dance, they both managed to step on each other's feet about 3 times. But they also discovered that they both loved dogs. And by the end of the dance, they agreed that the next week in school, they'd bring pictures of their dogs to show each other. And during the rest of that evening, Esmeralda danced with about 3 other boys who were having just a little bit of trouble getting the hang of this dance thing. She also danced with Mr. Driscoll again. She was actually having fun. At the end of the evening, as she came into the coat room to get her coat, there was Georgina Duquette on her tiptoes, trying to reach her hat on the top shelf. As Esmeralda glided by, she plucked the hat off the shelf. "Oh, here, Georgina, is this all you wanted?" Esmeralda didn't even wait to see Georgina's look of awe or hear her stuttered thank you. Esmeralda was out the door and on her way to reach as high as she could.
Fran Yardley with May I Have This Dance, a beautiful story about learning to love ourselves, no matter how different we may be from other people. And our next story is far more musical, every bit as fun, though. It's The Tortoise and the Hare Rap by the Storycrafters, the storytelling team of Jerry Burns and Barry Marshall. You've heard this classic tale about being slow and steady and how you can win the race that way, but you probably haven't heard it quite like this. Here are the Storycrafters with The Tortoise and the Hare Rap here on the Appleseed.
A long time ago, in a faraway place, two famous animals decided to race.
One was the tortoise.
He was the green one.
The other was the hare.
He was the mean one.
When Hare saw Tortoise walking from the east to the west, Hare would say,
"Are you still walking or did you stop for a rest?"
Tortoise liked to make egg souffles from scratch. Hare would say,
"Will you be done before those eggies hatch?"
See, Tortoise liked to take things easy and slow, but Hare was always on the go, go, go.
Tortoise admired views and he smelled the flowers. He would read, he would paint, he would meditate for hours. Tortoise baked his bread and he made his own clothes.
But Hare had no time for activities like those. He liked life in the fast lane on the jump, no doubt. He used a laundry service, went to the gym, and ate out.
And in between his meetings, Hare managed to find a minute to make fun of the green shell and the tortoise that was in it.
Hare's insults were sharp. He was always attacking.
"You're a slug, you're a sloth, you're the sultan of slacking. Tortoise, you are slower than a snail stuck in slime. Yo, you are the king of wasting time."
Now, Tortoise's shell was thick, but the hare was on his case. He'd had about enough.
"Hare, it's time for a race."
So the day for the race between our heroes was set.
Hare said,
"That's a day Tortoise will regret. On your mark, get ready, get set, and go." Hare zipped away.
Tortoise went with the flow.
Hare looked around. He was ahead, all right. So he sang a little song that was not so polite. "How are you ever gonna get any place? Moving as you do at tortoise pace."
Yeah, moving as you do at tortoise pace. When he finished the song, Tortoise was pretty far back. Hare said,
"I can do some work. I got plenty of slack."
He slowed to a jog.
"If this race don't beat all,"
pulled out his cell phone and made a conference call.
He was so caught up in talking that he went off the cement.
Then he had himself a little accident. Hare bumped into a tree. He felt a bit ill. Then he heard Tortoise catching up.
"Man, this is no time to chill."
Hare held on to his lead.
"Yeah, I'm doing all right."
So he sang the little song that was not so polite. He sang,
"You're just wasting my time. You call this a race? You'll go home in disgrace at tortoise pace.
You'll go home in disgrace
at tortoise pace."
When he finished the song, Tortoise was so far behind. Hare said,
"Time for me to go online."
He pulled out a handheld computer apparatus. He surfed and tweeted and posted his status.
He was blogging about the race when he heard a little cough.
Tortoise passed him by.
Hare didn't even log off. He went hip hip hopping at a frightening speed, and in no time at all, he was back in the lead.
Hare was moving so fast, he nearly took flight, and he sang the little song that is not so polite.
"I will leave you in the dust Without a trace, you don't stand a chance at Tortoise Pace.
You don't stand a chance
at Tortoise Pace.
Hare passed a house and noticed that inside there was a television on.
Well, his eyes opened wide.
He was locked in place in a couch potato stance. He was stuck in a TV trance.
He was still as a statue, eyes glued to the screen, his mouth hung to his knees.
It was an ugly scene. He would have sprouted some roots if it hadn't been for hearing all the spectators hooting and shouting and cheering.
Hare looked up and was shocked to see
that the tortoise had won.
This can't be happening to me.
Hare took off in a flash.
But he was yesterday's news.
Tortoise won some gold medals and was giving interviews.
Hare's ears flopped down.
Then he had a cosmic shift. Hare said,
I guess I'm not too swift.
Hare took Tortoise out to eat some bouillabaisse. Then he walked Tortoise home at Tortoise Pace.
Yeah, he walked Tortoise home
at Tortoise Pace.
After that day, Hare and Tortoise understood that many different paces make the world good.
So the next time somebody says, you're too slow,
or too young,
or too old,
or too high,
or too low,
tell them let others go at their own pace, and then everyone will win
in the human race.
The Tortoise and the Hare as a Rap, told for you by the Story Crafters, the storytelling team of Jerry Burns and Barry Marshall. We're going to wrap up today with a story from Laura K. Deal. Now, in this story, a kind woodcutter is kind to the trees and he's rewarded. But the cruel woodcutter? Well, we're going to find out from Laura K. Deal in this story called Sticky, Sticky Pine. Happy to bring it to you here on The Appleseed.
Long ago in Japan, there lived a poor woodcutter who gathered firewood to sell in his village. Despite his poverty and hunger, he was very kind. He never wanted to hurt any living thing, not animals, not trees. He knew that if a tree was hurt, it would ooze sap, just like a person would bleed if they got a scratch or a scrape. So he never broke the branches from a living tree. He only gathered the dead wood from the forest. One day he was out walking in the forest, looking for wood that had fallen. He was out near the center of the forest by his favorite old pine tree. He loved that tree and knew it was a symbol of good fortune. In fact, the year before he had found a little twig that the pine tree had dropped, and he carried it in his pocket for good luck. So this day, when he walked near the old pine, he heard a voice say, "Sticky, sticky is my sap, for my tender twigs are snapped." The woodcutter looked all around. "Who said that?" The voice came again. "Sticky, sticky is my sap, for my tender twigs are snapped." He walked around to the other side of the pine and saw three branches had been broken off the pine, and the broken places were oozing sap. It made his heart hurt to see it. The woodcutter tore a strip of cloth from the bottom of his robe and said, "Now these tender twigs I'll wrap, and in that way I'll stop the sap." And so he did. He wound that cloth around the ends of those broken branches. As soon as he had finished, the tree shivered. Then it shivered again, and a cascade of gold and silver coins came raining down from the tree and fell all around the woodcutter. He stared, amazed. Even though he knew the pine was a symbol of good fortune, he never expected it would actually give him money. He thanked the tree very kindly, and then he gathered up the coins in his basket and his robe and took them home. When he got there, he put the coins into baskets that he had at home, and the money just kept coming out of his robe until he had five baskets full of coins. He couldn't believe his good fortune. He knew he would never go hungry again, and he would be able to help the other poor people who lived in the village. But then, as he was counting his money, a face appeared in the window. It was another woodcutter. In fact, it was the mean woodcutter who had broken the branches on the pine tree in the center of the forest. He looked in and said, "Where did all those coins come from? That looks mighty good to me." Well, the kind woodcutter began to tell the other about the old pine in the middle of the forest, but he didn't even get to the part where the pine spoke before the mean woodcutter ran off to see for himself. He knew just which pine the kind woodcutter was talking about. As he approached, the old pine tree remembered him, and it said, "Sticky, sticky is my blood. Touch me, you'll receive a flood." "Oh," the mean woodcutter thought, "that's exactly what I want, a flood of coins." He grabbed another branch and snapped it off. But do you think that tree gave him coins? No, the pine tree covered him in sticky, sticky sap from head to toe. He couldn't move. He couldn't even call for help because he was afraid if he opened his mouth, the sap would get in. He was stuck for 4 days, one day for each branch that he had broken, before the sap softened and he could walk back to his village. And from that day on, he never broke a living branch from a tree again. In fact, he could be heard to say, "Fortune favors those who are kind."
Laura K. Deal with a story called Sticky, Sticky Pine. That's a story from a collection of stories called The Diffendaffer Taffy Cafe. A pleasure to bring you that tale, along with that rap, the Tortoise and the Hare rap from the Story Crafters, Barry Marshall and Jerry Burns. And, of course, before that, you heard May I Have This Dance, that lovely story by Fran Yardley. You heard at the top of the hour, of course, When I Was 10, a story told for you by Finn Billy. What a pleasure it's been to bring all these tales to you. You can find us online at byuradio.org/appleseed. There's an archive there filled with stories, many of which will already be favorites, along with tellers that will already be favorites, and plenty of new stuff, too, that will become favorites as you listen. You can Google the Appleseed podcast as well and subscribe for something new just about every day on the Appleseed. This hour was written by Alyssa Mingurance, and our audio engineer is Carly Robison. Our producer is Jeff Simpson. I'm Sam Payne. Always a pleasure to have you with us, and hope you'll join us again on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by the Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.